Seraphine has a very special place in my heart. She was living in a two-bedroom, imagine like mud brick walls, dirt floor, two-bedroom home in rural Rwanda. She is a married woman with 7 kids, so 9 people wow. in the house. And her husband's mother was also living with them. So we're talking about 10 people. And since I had seen her, she had taken out a loan. She had built a 4-bedroom house, had a back area, and had 4 cows, which cows are a sign of savings, wealth. They provide milk. You can cash them in for meat when you need some extra cash flow. So that was a huge source of pride for her. And she had built her mother-in-law an additional home. So much in rural area in Ghana and Uganda and Rwanda, you see hardship. You see marriages and they exist for economy of scale of 2 people bringing together whatever income they can, not for love. And it was just this amazing place of, this is what a home feels like. So I think about the days where we have our artisan celebrations and there's 2,000, 3,000 women that don on a field singing and dancing. And we have this huge celebration of the accomplishments we do. And those are really amazing moments for me too, when I look back on my impact journey. But if it wasn't for the grounding relationships, the individual ones of Seraphine.
Welcome back to Her CEO Journey. We are continuing with our impact reporting series. Last week, we spoke with Paulina, the co-founder and CEO of Unit of Impact, the first impact report platform designed especially for small businesses. And this week, in this series' second and last episode, we invited Alicia Wallace, co-founder and chief operating officer of All Across Africa. She shared with us what are the steps in creating a clear impact strategy, how to determine the key impact metrics, and how they gather the information. They understand a strategy without a system to keep it alive will not work. The impact All Across Africa creates not only give women the tool to create wealth and support their families at this moment, but this organization helps women across the African region to create regenerative wealth for decades. Alicia also shared how their impact strategy and reporting help them to connect with the right investors and lenders to grow both their impact and profit. Now, let's more about All Across Africa and Alicia CEO Journey. Alicia Wallace, welcome to Her CEO Journey. It is such a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you so much, Christina, for having me.
You are the founder and COO of All Across Africa. Can you share, before we dive into more details about your business model, the origin story of your business?
Our origin story really started with myself and my business partner having different experiences on the continent of Africa. Mine started with a volunteer trip to Sierra Leone. I was a senior in college. I had been studying economics and I knew that I wanted to do something to help, but I hadn't figured out what it was yet. I had a big bucket list for things I wanted to accomplish in my life. And on there was visit the continent of Africa. And so when I heard about this volunteer trip, I said yes. And I ventured to Africa, to Sierra Leone. And that's where my eyes were opened. And I saw things that I had never experienced before, like the lack of education and healthcare and a desire to work, but the missing opportunity for work. And when I came back to the US, I was so profoundly impacted by that, that I didn't feel like I could go on and climb the corporate ladder and get my MBA and help out the last third of my life, which was kind of the plan that I had built. I needed to do something now. And that put me on a journey to end up finding Greg Stone, who is leading a nonprofit called Rwanda Partners. He had started by venturing to Rwanda in 2004, which was 10 years post-genocide. And he went with a group of 50 Americans from Seattle, and they were invited by local community leaders in Rwanda to celebrate the 10-year anniversary. They literally went kind of a sightseeing and celebration trip. But similar to my experience in Sierra Leone, he came back, you know, brokenhearted and devastated by what he saw and experienced, but very optimistic and hopeful that he could find ways to partner and provide solutions to local leaders who had ideas to solve their own community needs. And he had started that nonprofit and was really experimenting when I met him. He was doing education and reconciliation and starting to dabble in job creation. We were sponsoring about 300 kids to go to a catch-up school. And it was there that my volunteer experience and starting with this nonprofit, I'm in Rwanda now working with Greg, and I'm meeting the parents of these kids, and they're saying, thanks for sending our kid to school, but what we really want are jobs. Like, we knew education was important. Our kids haven't been in school, not because we didn't have the knowledge, but because we don't have a safe place to sleep, because we don't have food on the table and we need them to go and farm. We don't have the time for them to not farm, or we don't eat as a family. And those were really impactful words that we had to listen to and say, is it education first, or is it solving basic needs? And how do we create those jobs? And that became the big question at All Across Africa when we launched in 2013, was really zeroing in and focusing on creating jobs and alleviating poverty in that way, providing women the income and the dignity to send their own kids to school and access education on their own at the right time for their family. Maybe they need food on the table first. Maybe they need a roof over their head. And maybe education comes after that. But let's give them the tools and the resources and the money and the education and confidence, and let them determine that future.
This is the interesting part, because when you met Greg, he was running a nonprofit. But when you decided and founded together with Greg All Across Africa, it becomes a for-profit. What is the light switch moment there where you said it's not for profit, but it should be for profit?
I think the interesting thing for us was, as we started to build the job creation side of the business, we landed a very big first customer called Costco. We started to do roadshows with them, and that was even under the nonprofit. And the board of the nonprofit started to see requests to buy inventory, and we needed to invest $50,000, $100,000 to buy inventory to go and sell it during the Christmas season. Well, a nonprofit board structure has a governing board that is responsible financially to the decisions that are being made by the nonprofit, right? And they all started to look at the numbers and say, this really sounds like a business. We want to achieve our mission and, you know, be raising money and partnering with people in Rwanda, but we aren't comfortable with signing our name to these loans for inventory, for building new markets. We had at the same time been researching, if we're not going to be a nonprofit, is there a viable model? We are a mission-based organization. And so how do we manage mission-based with that? And in 2012 and 13, there was a new type of business, that a corporate filing that was launched in California, and it's called benefit corporation. Then the certification for a benefit corporation is known as B Corp. But in our DNA, we file as a business, as a benefit corporation, which means we can weigh our stakeholders and our shareholders' interests equally. So as an executive, I get to make decisions in the best interests of both. We're a traditional business or for-profit C Corp. Legally, they had to comply with shareholders' best interests. And so it was really at this like amazing time where the benefit corporation and B Corp movement started to happen. And the nonprofit board and leaders were saying, like, this probably isn't the right fit for us, that we were able to transition that into that for-profit model. And now we can raise capital, you know, and we can get loans, and we do have a governing board, and we can sell equity in the company and build value over time for the best interests of artisans. Since then, we've been able to work with amazing family foundations that traditionally are giving their money to nonprofits, but there's been amazing progress towards foundations being able to invest in social businesses. And when we return that capital to them, they're able to recycle that either to a nonprofit or to a social business. And so there's been this amazing network of family foundations that has been able to come around our business. And so the type of equity that even our business is interested in is patient and artisan first, so impact first investment. And that's been key to us from day one, is that we would not bring in equity investors or raise capital that was looking for us to return a certain size profit or for us to sell on a certain timeline to realize their benefit or return.
I didn't realize that there are foundations out there who is willing to invest in a social impact business. That is a really interesting finding talking to you.
It's called program-related investments. And I think the last data that I saw was something like less than 5% of family foundations are giving through program-related investments because they don't know about it. We pay interest on loans, or they own equity in the company and we are building that value for them. But it's a way for them to expand their impact as a foundation. So giving that to a nonprofit that's going to consume it but not return it is totally fine. And they still do that giving, but being able to give it and invest it in a business that's returning interest and will return that money to them means that they can give it again with that interest and expand their impact. We have a lawyer that is always documenting it. And on the foundation side, they need to include certain things that there's no conflict of interest, you know, that their foundation isn't benefiting from this outside of interest. But that the what is the impact metrics and what is the mission to be achieved through this capital? So it's a very underutilized foundation tool that's helping social impact businesses grow.
It is important for you to have your impact strategy nailed down, because hearing what you just said about the program investing, it seems that if you don't know and you don't have a strategy for your impact, how are you even going to show this family foundation what exactly all across America is impacting the people in Africa?
A lot of our foundations have certain criteria that they're looking for. You know, they've set one of them specifically, $300 per life changed, a job created, and that we have to prove that we pull that person out of poverty over a time period. And so aligning with what their criteria is and their targeting, already knowing our DNA and our ethos and our metrics is really important.
Let's go back a little bit to your idea. In 2013, the focus is really about creating jobs. When you thought about, we want to create project, can you share like what are those steps that you and Greg did to come up with the cooperative business model that you have right now?
First, we were really just experimenting with job creation in general. We were looking around in the rural communities and we were saying, what's missing? What kind of value could we provide? And so we started with chicken and egg farms and pineapple plantations. But what we observed was introducing those new creations into their market that didn't exist in the rural areas. There wasn't enough new cash and new capital to acquire that and really impact that person's life. So, you know, at a micro level, we're physically watching women show up to market with pineapple, and we're seeing the buyer decide between the tomatoes they already would be buying, you know, at the produce stand, or between like a new pineapple. And what we saw was potentially they're experimenting and buying pineapple, but then it's at the cost of the tomato producer's livelihood. And so that's when we really started to shift our mindset on like, if we're going to tackle poverty and change people's lives in our lifetime, in their lifetime, what is that going to take? And we started to dabble with that export market, exporting a product, importing US dollars, increasing aggregate demand. Now that artisan is going to the marketplace with new US dollars we wired into the country and reintroduced into her hands. She can afford meat, she can afford pineapple, tomatoes, whatever. Now that person she's paying has additional income and a job. Overall, we were able to see how that could increase everyone's lives in their community and overall contribute to an increase in GDP. And so that started to like click and solve the issues that we needed. It was very helpful that it was at the same time that Costco, a buyer, had found our product, had told us this would make a great roadshow and expressed interest. And we were able to build supply and demand at the same time. Some of the biggest challenges in artisan businesses is matching that chicken and egg of how do I develop a product and pull people together to like learn this craft and to build something amazing. Meanwhile, I'm going to race to the country where I'm trying to sell it, get buyers engaged, get a buying timeline, come back to those people who haven't had work and try and re-engage them to make this product for me on some unknown timeline. So it can be very challenging to match supply and demand. And by getting those two together, we were really able to turn this engine on and start to see that impact flow through. And that was what kind of landed us on this. Okay, it's really about creating jobs in these communities. And this is how we're going to solve so many other issues in addition to it by getting really focused on this one problem.
How did the cooperative come about?
a great question. Yes. So cooperative was our experience in those farming cooperatives, setting up a cooperative for chicken and eggs, setting up a cooperative for pineapples. So understanding that Rwanda already has this natural co-op training and inclination. Things are very organized there. They're very aware already of what a president, a vice president, a secretary is. There are different roles. There's a government structure for them to be registered and recognized as an entity. Post-genocide, their president, Paul Kagame, did a lot of work with how to benefit workers, how to unionize within the country. So there's a co-op for everything. Everyone belongs to a co-op and understands that it provides additional safety nets. So globally, there might be things like unemployment or access to social services. In most countries in Africa, that doesn't exist. But in a co-op model, you can be paid for your service, but then the co-op can require you to save 5%. And then when hard times fall, you can either take out a loan for the co-op, or if the quality wasn't met, you can get a small payout for materials from the co-op. And so it's a way to manage risk and plan for the future. And we were able to build off of Rwanda's strength of already having that co-op structure in place. And there's a lot of training and a lot of structure that we still do and add, but there was already that natural framework there. And since then, we've taken that co-op model to Uganda, where it's less familiar, and additionally to Ghana, also where it's less familiar.
So I'm curious, the first cooperative in Rwanda, can you give a little bit background? Even though they already have the framework, you said that there's still training and support. What kind of training? What kind of support? What are the challenges?
Yeah, so there's two co-ops that kind of come to mind. One was Priscilla's and another was Seraphine's. And I'll kind of give you a perspective of both, just to contrast. Priscilla's was the first that I had been introduced to. And she wasn't formally registered with the government at the time. She understood the co-op model. She was very much acting as the president and the natural leader, but had not necessarily like had a formal election, hadn't been registered with the government. But everyone knew her to be a natural leader. Things were cash at the time, so there wasn't the bank account with the double signer. And then contrasting that with Seraphine, that also had co-op experience, but was more established. She was registered with the government. She had her treasure and her on the bank account. They did have a bank account. They did have a cooperative code of conduct for themselves and their members and a savings account. And so what that looked like for us was learning from what are the opportunities for us. In the beginning, we didn't know fully how they should function or what we should do, right? So it was like, okay, now we're understanding what an advanced co-op looks like. We need to help Priscilla get there. And so we hosted an election and she was voted into leadership, but we needed to host that election and paper it that it was a legitimate voting in, determine the term, determine the rest of the code of conduct for the co-op, which means how much are they saving from the overall income? How much goes to the leadership and how much goes to what type of additional investment? So each co-op gets to pick, do they want a rotating savings fund? Do they want to buy land? Do they want to own a storefront? Many of them over time do lots of different things. You'll find a successful co-op in Rwanda owns farmland, owns a storefront. They own a vehicle that they employ someone in the village to drive and they earn income that way. And they have a rotating savings fund that each woman can apply to and get $100 microloan for that year, interest-free. So the more robust ones get to do more over time because they're saving more and earning more. And so we really have defined it as this beginning, intermediate, and advanced levels of cooperatives. And, you know, at each stage, there's different expectations for how they manage their legal filing, how they manage and register their members, what kind of training they provide to their members, on down to like, do they have a registered bank account and all of those things. So we're really working to get everyone to an advanced stage, but knowing that that doesn't happen overnight. And so our teams, production managers, co-op managers are on the ground and providing that in the village, training to them, hosting those elections, helping them understand how to open a bank account, teaching them debits and credits and a basic accounting system, registering their members and getting formal IDs. A lot of that has to do with our own DNA, but then additionally, we've layered in what's called the Nest Seal. And the Nest Seal is ethical and transparent wages and an assurance for anybody, consumers, retailers, et cetera, that we are legitimately determining a fair wage. We are paying a fair wage. We're ensuring that the environment is taken care of. We're ensuring there's no children in the workforce. It's basically, how do you build happy and healthy homeworking production? Like, how does that happen beyond a four-wall factory? And a lot of that now lives within even our co-op DNA structure and new guidelines and requirements that we've grown into over time.
I believe up to now, all across Africa is working with 104 cooperatives in 5 countries. Those cooperatives are producing this nice art that they sell to you. They sell to you, they earn income, and they can support their own cooperative. And then all across Africa is selling their products to businesses in the US.
That's correct. I think there's a couple additional things in the front of that, which is we're designing the product. Mm. So we work with designers globally. We're trend forecasting the products, designing them. We train the artisans on the quality, the production, the manufacturing. There's often a local skill set, right, or technique that has been established, but not always. Mm-hmm. And so in some cases, even today, we have an order with a very large multinational retailer. We're talking hundreds of thousands of pieces, but the price point for them needed to be super efficient. And so that would not manage our traditional Rwandan coil weave with sisal, could not meet that price point and that cost structure. We still have a daily wage, an hourly wage that we're working towards, but from a margin perspective and value of the product, we needed somebody to be able to make 3 products a day in order for them to achieve the wage that we need them to earn from a living wage perspective and for the retailer to manage the margin. And so we created this like braided, efficient, fast product for them and have increased their market by doing this. And so I think the important piece is that these cooperatives don't necessarily know what the market is looking for or how to manage materials and price. And so that's where the value of All Across Africa shows up, is that we're partnering with retailers, we're designing those products, we're training the artisans, but we're also establishing the co-ops in a way and holding them accountable as well. So even Seraphine today, 12 years later, she's still working with us and we audit her books regularly. We come in and we look at her wage records and we look at what she's paying her artisan per piece and what we've communicated that we're paying. And we ensure that those things are happening. We attend trainings that she's giving and make sure that what's being communicated is in compliance. And we go out and we spot check the homes to make sure that the neighbors don't say that the children are involved, that the neighbors' children don't tell us that the children are involved, right? So even if a co-op is established, they still have a needed value and partnership on both sides. You know, they're providing value to us, but we are additionally providing them with the leadership support and the capacity to run a successful co-op.
This is what intrigued me. I saw on the website, you work with big brands like Starbucks, Saks Fifth Avenue, QVC, Nordstrom, Disney. All of these big brands are not public benefit corporation. They are still in the mindset of what is beneficial for their shareholders. How do you make sure when you negotiate with them in terms of pricing, you continue to support the artisan that you work with, yet your pricing can still be competitive for these big brands?
I think we're in a very interesting time, and we have for some years, but especially in post-COVID, we're seeing these brands and companies really understanding that if you're not, you can't just be about shareholder interest. You really have to be about people and planet, or consumers are going to turn against you. They care. Like, your customer cares that you also care. And so in our case, we are a way for retailers to show up and communicate to their customers, like, we do care about people and planet, and we become environmental social good program partner to many of these companies looking to expand their impact. And through that lens, they are understanding and willing to pay more. They want us and need us to have the seal and to agree to have the standard and wage. And they want exceptional quality. They want something really unique and different. And that's going to cost them more. There's been a lot of studies that have been published both by Nest and by others, that consumers are willing to pay 10, 15, on up to 18% more for a product if it is sustainably made or social and ethically made. And so those are important things that the retailers are like leaning into. And in some cases, they can inch that price up a tiny bit. And in other cases, they're like, this isn't the place where we need to make all of our margin. Like, we can look at our assortment as a margin mix, and we're going to get a little bit of better margin over here and a little less from all across Africa in this product line. But overall, that blended is hitting our target. It's also on us as a company to be building value in that product and creating efficiency for those retailers still to have margin, knowing that that's their goal. And so we, like I shared that story of building a product that three of them could be made in a day, those were time wage studies. We had to bring experts in. We had to bring product development team members from other countries in to sit and to say, if this is the price that this retailer can pay, this is the price we have to afford for our artisans to make every day, how do we get so efficient through this supply chain that we can produce this and deliver on this order? And that becomes the company's biggest challenge. And those are challenges that we've built a skill set and we've been able to overcome.
Now, how do you even get there, Alicia? How do you even have that exact process, the thought process? Okay, here's our the methodology that we want to develop to create sustainable production practices.
Yeah, I think calling it a journey is the appropriate word, because I don't think there was just like a moment where it happened. Our business model was not one of academics where we wrote it out and then we went and raised capital and then it was lived into existence. This was a model that was experimental. You know, this was a series of going on these trips, of starting to volunteer, of starting a nonprofit, of meeting local leaders along the way, throwing things on the wall and experimenting and landing on this business model with the luck of a Costco buyer finding our product and feeling like it was a fit. By those things kind of coming into being, knowing that at our ethos, we wanted to help people. So all along the way, it was like, okay, now we have this Costco line of business. Like, how do we make sure it still helps people, right? Like, how are we protecting our workers? How are we? And every year we were able to kind of like push that forward in a different way and add on a new program, add on one single new team member over time. So we started the business in 2013, but the Nest seal wasn't published at the UN until 2018. So we had our own DNA and how we like created our code of conduct, how we assured people we paid fair wages. And Nest came along and said, oh, a lot of these are really great ideas. Can we take these elsewhere? Oh, and we want you to implement these things, right? But it was in partnership. And over time, the Nest standard and rigor grows each year. So we have more and more requirements to meet. So even as a company today, we're continuing to grow into that. We're not selling out to investors who aren't willing to be patient or aren't impact first, and that we have the right leadership that's asking the right questions and the right team members on the ground that cares. Big part for Greg and I is that we were investing in local leadership and that this was something that was going to live beyond us. And my first few years, I was on the ground in Rwanda most of the time, building the model, learning, understanding, engaging. Then it was 50% of the time. COVID wasn't there at all. Post-COVID, I now have a 2 and 4 year old at home and I get there 3 times a year to our different countries in Africa. But we're thriving. We have amazing leadership on the ground. We have great team members that are building this into place. It's just been this process of getting the right people, of staying focused on the mission, of having the right conversations, and just that slow build, but at the same time, aggressive enough that we are seeing the needle move towards impact. Had to see the business pick up enough for us to move volume, for us to talk about employing thousands and really get to understand what that looks like at a high volume in order to see real change being made on a more of a macro level.
Did you ever feel pressure to grow your revenue?
We always feel pressure to grow our revenue because we know that through our revenue, we're creating more impact for people, right? That is like the driving source. So revenue leading to cost of goods and margin, and cost of goods is into the hands of artisans, and being able to do the math on how much cost of goods do we spend each year, how many artisans are we employing, gives us, you know, that really clear understanding of per person, what does that look like for income and their impact? So we're always pressured. I mean, it's not necessarily external pressure. Our board is very aggressive for impact numbers, and they also know that revenue means that, but not revenue that's risky or not revenue that puts us in a place of jeopardy of not maintaining sustainability. But more than just environmental sustainability, sustainability of the company, sustainability of our staff, that we're in it for the long run, that this isn't just something that we're going to do for the next few years, but that in our lifetime, we will continue to pursue this mission until poverty across Africa is alleviated, yeah. Right? And so driving revenue and growing it is always keeps me up in the night. It's what I wake up worried about. And I would say, you know, every business leader I know, that's top of mind for them as well.
I think even though you are focusing on the revenue, yes, because it's a business, you need to have revenue. Without revenue, you're not going to go anywhere. But at the same time, you pinpoint your cost of goods is the cost of all this, the income for all these artisans. I'm assuming you're probably going to figure out your cost of goods first because that is important to them. Then you work out your revenue because then you have to also have overhead costs, right? At the corporate level or in the US level. I think the way you think about revenue is different than if you are just a business that care for the shareholders.
Often it is how you're talking about it, of building it from cost of goods up. In some cases, more recently, we've been able to find opportunities where something is already being sold in a market, in a retailer, and it's been produced in a manufacturing setting, and they're willing to move it to handcrafted if we can get things to a certain price or to a certain place. And that's, again, where we're like reverse engineering it. But that's also where we're creating more impact and being able to recruit more jobs through that. It's this interesting mix of like, we need a certain level of revenue at a certain margin and cost of goods that's keeping people working regularly, right? Mm-hmm. We're looking for everyday jobs. Something that plagues the artisan industry is big order today, have it for the next month or two, nothing for 3 months. It's that cyclical part of retail of we're up, we're down, we're up, we're down, that makes artisans, their future very unstable, and also their confidence in leaving whatever alternative income they have very low to like move into the artisan space. And so our biggest question is like, how do we level that? How do we diversify our sales channels enough that we have a base of business that's everyday income that we can control? And then we're going to get the like big up and the down, and the big up and the down again, those will be on top of base business, but people know what they can count on. And those are everyday challenges that we're internally solving. And post-COVID, the market has thrown us up and it's thrown us down with even our own base business, right? And what we thought we could count on. And so it's quite challenging. It's something that our board is tackling with us, you know, regularly right now. It's like, how do we grow revenue? How do we grow consistency and that income for artisans that we all know and can predict to some level, but knowing that it's retail and it's cyclical and not guaranteed.
Yeah. Retail is tough. And I get it. It's all about creating that balance. But now, how does your business model lead you to create the impact strategy that you want for all across Africa?
Our impact strategy is around number of producers that we're working with and the quality of those jobs. So being able to understand how much income is actually earned. Are we a primary or secondary source of income? Have we taught and trained them how to invest and diversify that income? So from an education perspective, we're sizing that up as well. And how many dependents is this supporting? We had a really amazing impact study that was done where a team of students and a professor came to Rwanda, and they were starting to measure not just the impact on the artisan, which they were doing, but it was the economic benefit as a whole to that community. And what they determined was through that aggregate demand, that increased spending that artisan had, and them buying meat in the market, them buying more produce, them buying clothes for their kids, because now they have income, it was increasing local jobs. For every artisan, there was 1.5 jobs created locally in their economy. And I mean, right down to saving more money at the bank, you know, so there was a higher demand for bank tellers, people fixing their roofs. So contractors had more work. So it was really amazing to get to see that. So when we talk about creating jobs and creating that labor demand, we're first and foremost measuring it through our artisans. But as our business has grown and as we've understood visually, physically, we're out there, we can see it happening. And then we were able to measure it. We've started to understand the greater impact for the labor market and the demand in jobs that we're creating there. And so that's been a key driver for us as we talk about family foundations getting involved and other people understanding this impact, is that an artisan job isn't just benefiting that one person. They're on average supporting 5.7 dependents with their income, 85% in school rate within year one. And then that they're also spending more money in the community and creating these additional jobs. And so it's really the jobs, number of jobs created and quality of jobs are like the two main key components. And then over time, we've done other studies, which are on how long does it take the bottom quartile, the last 25% of our artisans, the lowest income, to actually escape poverty. So meaning that they can access safe housing, that they have food on the table, that they can access education, healthcare, and save 10%. Those are kind of our five impact pillars. And usually we're like in that study, we're seeing year three, the lowest, the slowest last 25% quartile, not the average, not the median, but that last 25% achieve those five impact metrics. Our impact strategy has evolved over time as we've learned, as we've listened, as we've been in their homes and we've seen what's important to them, and really just like understanding how best to help. You think you have an idea and you go in with that, and then you really understand that's either not hitting the mark or that's not important to them, or we need to be looking at this in a different way. So it's been a journey for sure.
So did you engage the artisans when you are creating this five impact pillars?
We engaged artisans from the sense that we were in their homes learning and listening to them on where are they economically? What are their dreams and their goals for their future? What does that take to get to that next step? Our early findings in the school were we need a safe house and food. And so we went out and continued to validate those points with artisans. And we started to see when they did have income early on, those were the two first needs that they're meeting. They're not worried about paying school fees for their kid with their first paycheck. They're like, hey, we've got a roof leak and it's damaging the food that I'm harvesting. I don't have a safe place to store it. The floor in our house is muddy and wet. Like, I need to patch this. We need to fix where we live first. And so we continued to validate that point. And then we were seeing people, once they were eating healthy, once they had safe housing, that they were starting to access education. They're paying for their kids to go to school. And so they felt like they had enough confidence and the foresight to be able to send their kids to school. And then it was about accessing healthcare. Like, okay, now we're going to be alive. Now we're going to be healthy. Now we're going to, you know, survive this. Like, let's access healthcare. And there's some really great programs in the areas where we work where they're subsidizing like a health insurance type of program for artisans and others. And so they're able to access that healthcare. And along the way, we're building that relationship with them, that consistency. They're seeing that income over time. And we're teaching and training on savings and what the savings look like. And we partnered with Opportunity Bank, a local bank, and they had a really great training curriculum that we adopted, and they did a train the trainers. And that's a savings curriculum that we're able to take out both to the co-ops, but also to the individuals. We started to notice that people were actually accumulating debt because they weren't understanding income to expenses. So we started teaching very basic curriculum of like how to calculate your monthly income, how many hours you work for all across Africa, how many baskets you produce, how to understand what that cost is, and then how to calculate your expenses so that you still can save for your future. And so once they had the comfort and the ability to learn, then they're absorbing it. it was not slow, but it wasn't like we just had this academic methodology. It was sitting with these women, learning from these women, being out with different team members, and just really getting into kind of the life beat of their culture and what's important to them and how are they looking at changing their own lives. But then at what point do they need more information or knowledge to be making the best decision as well?
Can anybody join the cooperative? Or if there is a certain type of artisans that you want to partner and you want to employ, or you want them to join the cooperative?
So traditionally, co-ops needed and members needed to have a certain type of skill set. So they needed to know how to make this really quality, high craft weave. And Seraphine and other leaders would recruit women in their village to come into their house and to train with them every day for a couple of weeks, right? And so it was in Seraphine's best interest to grow her membership and to grow her group. And so she would train and teach that skill set. More recently, as we've diversified from only being a really high quality traditional craft to also finding really economical ways to make functional high value products for retailers, we are recruiting unemployed workers to come in and we're training them. This is not a very highly technical artisan craft. 100%, it is still artisan craft. Someone's creating something with their hands, but it's not the really high skill set. They are following a recipe and they are coming in and they are learning how to use their hands to create value. And we have the recipe built for them and we can teach them how to do that. So it was always first about the skill set and the talent. And as we've grown and we've developed these opportunities, we're able to continue to see more mission fulfillment by getting to recruit those who don't have that skill set. And there's a demand for both. We have a demand for very high quality handbags and very high quality weave. And then there's that really functional, affordable product that we just need a storage basket for our kids, for their toys. That was our biggest question is like, how do we not say artisan craft is only for high quality or only for the niche? And that's been our biggest mission is if our mission is about creating jobs and about putting dollars in the hands of rural home workers, we have to crack the code of scale and creating high value production at a volume that's going to build that reliability and consistency with retailers and at the same time employ a macro number of people to really see that impact that we want to see. So we do both and it's a really interesting place to be. And I think we have a lot more that we can expand on now that we've built a skill set for high volume and affordable price points and exceptionally high quality and niche products.
Now, a few things that if you can help my audience to understand, if they are looking to create an impact strategy and an impact reporting, what would your recommendation in terms of steps that they can learn from you in creating your impact strategies and metrics?
Something that was really important for us, we had been on the ground, we had been working with artisans, we definitely developed our own questionnaires and methodology, but none of us had had the experience in that. Through time, I've posted, you know, on different Facebook groups, and I've found people who are involved in like metrics and monitoring in different companies. And so we've had consultants come in and help, you know, shape our framework, but we've also partnered with universities, professors and students looking to measure impact, be exposed to it, and help us develop further thinking around what are even the drop downs to these questions and what are we really getting at through these questions and how do we make sure we're serving an accurate data set. And so a lot of that has been in partnership with others who want to learn or who have that experience. And it's a tool that we've sharpened internally, but I wouldn't say it was one that we had from the outset. And I think our biggest journey is just finding those partners. We Santa Clara University has a phenomenal school of entrepreneurship there. It's called the Miller Center. And they are very dedicated to helping, you know, social enterprises measure, gauge their impact. And they put a lot of resources into that. And those have been very close partners in us building over time that skill set and that focus. And also the capacity, because as a business, we're paying for that impact. So not just in the way that we're paying artisans, but we have to take the time away from building more value for artisans to even measure that, to even report on that. By having a partner that can help you in that, that's interest is embedded in social good, is it helps us run faster and harder. And so I would say finding impact partners is a key to that strategy. You know, learning and knowing it yourself, living and breathing it, and having the questions asked, but at the same time, finding others along the way that can add value to it and help you accelerate that is really important.
So basically, don't try to take on everything on your own.
That's my recommendation. Yes. I would not say take on, you can't be experts at everything, right? And for us, we are experts at developing these products. We're experts at producing the products in a rural area. Then it's shipping them, right? And logistically getting them out into the world, making these retail partnerships. Those are a lot of things to be really good at. And so we also need to be really good at our impact and telling that story, but we're not afraid to raise our hand and ask for help along the way and get others involved to help us do that.
I completely understand why it requires help and partner with someone, because your impact page, it's amazing. And I'm pretty sure it's a lot of work in the background.
It is. It's a lot of work in the background. We're
probably
really excited
have your
to have
own team to just like do impact.
We do. And there's also a time of year when we kind of slow things down and turn it off and we get our entire team engaged and out in the field. It's also a really great time for them to engage with the artisans and slow down from just logistics and shipping and enter into the women's homes and say, how's it going? How are we doing? How are you doing? We definitely have that survey that's about the check boxes and the filled in numbers and the dropdowns, but we have a lot of boxes that are around quotes and telling us and feedback, and we read through those. And those are the things that drive us. Yeah. And they're also the things that sharpen us, right? Because that's an opportunity to hear feedback that we need to hear to make us a better organization.
So what is your proudest moment in your impact journey?
We've talked about Seraphine. Seraphine has a very special place in my heart. Thinking about my proudest moment, I was in her home and she was so proud to show me around. I had seen that she had built a new home, but she was living in a 2-bedroom, imagine like mud brick walls, dirt floor, 2-bedroom home in rural Rwanda. She is a married woman with 7 kids, so 9 people wow. in the house. And her husband's mother was also living with them. So we're talking about 10 people. And since I had seen her, she had taken out a loan. She had built a 4-bedroom house, had a back area, and had 4 cows, which cows are a sign of savings, wealth. They provide milk. You can cash them in for meat when you need, you know, some extra cash flow. So that was a huge source of pride for her. And she had built her mother-in-law an additional home. Her husband came home from farming. He was a farmer previously and still was when I was there, wearing a buttoned-up white, very nice shirt and a big smile on his face. And he greeted me, but he also threw his arm around her and he was like, I am so proud of her. And he was just like, look at me. Look how sharp I look. Look how smart I look. I'm employing my neighbors now. We've bought additional land and I can employ my community and I don't have to break my back anymore in the field. And she was laughing at him, but there was joy there. And so much in rural area in Ghana and Uganda and Rwanda, you see hardship. You see marriages and they exist for economy of scale of 2 people bringing together whatever income they can, not for love. And it was just this amazing place of, this is what a home feels like. This is what I'm working for in my own life in the US, right? Is like happiness, joy, a place to belong, a legacy to leave my children with, a place for my mother to safely live. So I think about the days where we have our artisan celebrations and there's 2,000, 3,000 women that don on a field singing and dancing. And we have this huge celebration of the accomplishments we do. And those are really amazing moments for me too, when I look back on my impact journey. But if it wasn't for the grounding relationships, the individual ones of Seraphine, my business partners in Rwanda, and sends me a picture and is like, Seraphine sends her greetings, like she wishes you well. And if it weren't for those, then the macro picture doesn't feel relatable. Yeah. It needs a face and a name. And it's those times getting to go to those individual homes and see the dignity, the joy, and the progress.
And know that all across Africa make a difference in their life. It's touching. I can feel it from your voice, how proud you are. Alicia, this has been touching. I'm grateful that we can have this conversation. I'm grateful that you are sharing your journey. And I really hope many of the listener can learn from all across Africa. I know we kind of talk about a little bit about business, a little bit about the impact journey, but I think it's really important to understand the impact. There is a relation between business model and impact. So I'm grateful that I got to know all across Africa. So thank you so much for being here, Alicia. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed our conversation today.
And that's bring us to the end of another episode. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Her CEO Journey, the business finance podcast for mission-driven women entrepreneurs. When you are ready to grow to the next level and seeking a finance team and a fractional CFO who are all in on your mission and can help you maximize profit to make a bigger social impact, connect with us at theprofitreimagine.com/letschat.